We'll proceed to the sixth case, Brumfield versus the City of Chicago. Ms. Rents.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. Appellant Brumfield respectfully requests that this Court find that the District Court erred when it granted the defendant's 12b6 motion to dismiss. The District Court's error was rooted in an improper reading of the plaintiff's argument. The District Court stated on pages 27 and 28 of the short appendix that the plaintiff alleged that she was suspended and ultimately fired not on account of her alleged disability, but rather because of an investigation into an unrelated incident from June of 2006. This is simply not what the plaintiff alleged in her complaint. The plaintiff has consistently alleged that the January 21st, 2010 order of the Chicago Police Department, of the Chicago Police Board to suspend and ultimately terminate was arbitrary and unreasonable because the city not only refused to accommodate the plaintiff's disability, but took affirmative steps to exacerbate the plaintiff's disability, causing the plaintiff to become unable to work as a police officer. The Supreme Court has held in Skinner versus Switzer that
What is the disability? What is the disability alleged to be?
Yes, Your Honor. The disability alleged to be was an inability to sleep, to eat, and to concentrate. Now, this court has held all three of those things to be disabilities under the ADA.
And how was that to be accommodated?
Your Honor, that could have been accommodated in a number of ways. The Chicago Police Department became aware of the plaintiff's disabilities, and this is proven based on the repeated psychological examinations that they required of her.
Those all took place after the incident where she gets out of the squad car and falls down, which is the basis for the termination.
That is incorrect, Your Honor. Two of the examinations actually occurred prior to the incident. And that shows that the police department had knowledge or at least was aware that there was some psychological disability. It is also important to note that the third of the examinations was required less than a month after the incident.
Did any of the results of those examinations show a difficulty with sleeping, eating, or concentration?
The record only reflects that the results of the examination show that the plaintiff was able to continue as a police officer.
Fit for duty.
However, that she was susceptible to workplace stress. Now, the Chicago Police Department was informed of this from the psychologist on at least one occasion. And instead of taking any accommodations...
What is the accommodation?
Your Honor, the Chicago Police Department could have done a number of things. They could have allowed the plaintiff to be changed assignments. They could have changed the
plaintiff. Stress-free police assignment.
Stress-free, perhaps not, Your Honor, but there is a possibility that there could have been something that could have limited the plaintiff's stress. We're not asking for the police department to do everything possible to eliminate stress. Any job may have some stress. However, the Chicago Police Department took no action. They took no attempt to alleviate the disability. Instead, they exacerbated the problem. Now, this is shown in the three times that they brought termination proceedings in front of the Chicago Police Board. And it is important to note the curious timing of these three charges. The first one occurred in August of 2008. Now, in that instance, the Chicago Police sought termination of the plaintiff. However, the plaintiff was suspended for 180 days without pay or medical benefits. Medical benefits, which likely she could have used with her psychological issues. Now, curiously, 2 days before the end of that suspension, the Chicago Police Department filed a second set of termination charges. The incident in this set of termination charges stems from an event that occurred 3 years prior to the bringing of these charges. That timing is also curious. Again, the police board did not terminate the plaintiff, and the Chicago Police Department brought a third set of charges. Now, this set of charges stems from the incident that the district court noted in their ruling, the incident where the plaintiff admittedly stated that she would be injured on the job and the next day fell, and the police board found that she feigned injury. However, the plaintiff does not allege in her complaint that that was why she was fired. She alleges that she was fired because of her disability and the defendant's refusal to accommodate that disability. Now, the district court itself noted that if a plaintiff said that they had a disability, that the defendant was aware of the disability, and that the defendant failed to accommodate the disability, that would be a basis for liability under the ADA. It is exactly what the plaintiff has pled here. The district court simply came to the wrong conclusion. We can find all of this by looking to the complaint itself. This is a 12B6 motion. The standard is relatively low. The plaintiff need only state a plausible claim, a short and plain claim for which relief can be granted. And the plaintiff here did this. She stated that she had a disability, that she was unable to sleep, unable to eat, and unable to concentrate. She stated that the defendant was aware of her disability, that they sent her to psychological testing on four different occasions, and one of which of those occasions was right after the incident in June of 2006. And finally, the defendant did nothing to accommodate this disability. The plaintiff alleged that, in fact, the defendant exacerbated the disability. Under the ADA and under Wisconsin Community Services, that is enough to state a plausible claim, and therefore, the court erred when it granted the defendant's motion to dismiss.
One of these cases raises a Title I discrimination claim. The other raises a Title II discrimination claim. Why is the Title II employment discrimination claim cognizable?
Your Honor, you are correct that the first claim was a Title II claim and the second was a Title I claim. The district court allowed the Title II claim to go forward under that theory because the Seventh Circuit and the Supreme Court has not ruled that Title II claims.
Okay, but now you're talking to us, so you have to convince us that an employment discrimination claim is cognizable under Title II.
Yes, Your Honor. Under Title II of the ADA, the plaintiff needs to be a qualified individual with a disability. Here, she was a full-time police officer, and she has alleged disabilities that have been recognized by this court under the ADA. She must have been discriminated against or denied some public entity's services or programs. Here, she was denied the ability to continue as a police officer. She was denied accommodations from the police department, and she was denied future...
This isn't a public services claim. This is an employment claim.
Yes, Your Honor.
An employment discrimination claim is a Title I claim.
Your Honor...
Title II addresses discrimination in the denial of public services or... other public programs or activities. There's a distinction between the two.
Your Honor, while it is true that Title I does specifically note employment, there is a circuit split, and several circuits have allowed Title II claims to go forward on employment basis. The district court further allowed this case to continue under Title II, and the Supreme Court has refused to rule on an issue. There is nothing barring the plaintiff from bringing her claim under Title II.
Which circuits hold that Title II is cognizable and which hold that it is not?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I do not have that information in front of me, but I believe it is in the brief. I could supplement the record if necessary.
The Tenth Circuit last week issued a decision holding that employment discrimination claims are not cognizable under Title II. So to the extent that there's a pre-existing circuit split, it's now becoming lopsided against your position.
Your Honor, while it may be true that it is lopsided against our position, the plaintiff does believe that she still has been denied public services under her claim. Thank you.
Let me just ask you, do you have any case which suggests the mere that simply stating psychological problems is specific enough to identify a disability?
Your Honor, while specifically stating psychological problems may not be enough to identify a disability, that is an evidentiary finding that would have to take place at a later court stage. At the claim stage, the plaintiff need not give her evidence stating how she has a disability. She need only plead that she had the disability.
Well, I'm thinking of what the employer would do just when the claim is that I'm disabled before we go to court. What should an employer have in hand beyond the claim of psychological problems?
Your Honor, the employer knowing, there have been cases in this circuit and others that state that when a psychological disability is at hand, the plaintiff need not come forward to the employer because it may be unreasonable in light of the disability. Here the employer was aware of the disabilities. They showed their awareness by continually asking for the psychological examinations, yet they took no steps to accommodate them.
Well, those inquiries, could they just as well have spoken as to fit for duty as opposed to a disability, assuming there's a difference?
Your Honor, while it is true that the inquiries ended in the plaintiff being titled as fit for duty, the police department's own procedures in E06/06 require a psychological examination such as this one when psychological symptoms are observed, meaning someone in the police department thought that behaviors of the plaintiff were psychologically induced. And that is why the defendant would have required the examinations.
Thank you. Ms. Layton?
May it please the court. Counsel? Your Honors, Ms. Brumfield filed two lawsuits with overlapping claims regarding the same termination. In reply, she asked the court to gloss over the second lawsuit and proceed directly to the first lawsuit. But we suggest instead that this court begin by clearing away the waived issues. In particular, Ms. Brumfield failed in her opening brief to challenge the only ground that the district court raised for deciding the second lawsuit, which was res judicata. In light of that waiver, we urge the court to affirm the dismissal without deciding any issue regarding the Title I claim. Turning to the first lawsuit, Ms. Brumfield's complaint alleged Title II claim and Rehabilitation Act claim. With respect to the Title II claim, we urge that the court affirm the dismissal on the ground that Title II does not apply to employment claims for the reasons that we state in our brief. And with respect to the Rehabilitation Act claim, we urge affirmance on the ground that the district court properly found that the complaint fails to allege that Ms. Brumfield has a disability or that she was terminated because of her disability. In the interest of time this morning, I intend to focus my remarks on the Rehabilitation Act claim unless there are questions regarding anything else. First of all, regarding Ms. Brumfield's failure to plead termination because of her disability, at most, she's alleged two parallel tracks, that she has psychological problems and that she was terminated. But the Rehabilitation Act requires an allegation of a bridge between those, that there was one caused the other. And Ms. Brumfield has failed to plead any sort of link. She's alleged that the city questioned her fitness for duty in 2007. 1 year later, in 2008, began disciplinary proceedings, and then ultimately in 2010, terminated her. It's quite a leap from those facts to an allegation that she was terminated because of her disability, and that's what's required. It's not enough to allege she was terminated because the city failed to accommodate a disability, or even as what the reply brief suggests, which is that the city gaslighted her and caused her, you know, her disability to be exacerbated. What the ADA requires, the Rehabilitation Act requires, is actual link that the city's terminated her because of her disability. She also alleges that regarding the curious timing of those particular when we the city sent her for evaluations for fitness for duty, that the timing was, this court should make note, that in 2007 she was sent for these evaluations, but it wasn't until 2008 that the city began disciplinary proceedings, and the termination did not come until 2010. And it's also,
what were those fitness for duty exams after this incident where she fell getting out of the squad car, or were they some before and some after?
The record is silent, actually, regarding that. There is not even in the briefs that they don't lay out the timing of it. My understanding of it is that there was an incident that occurred around, 2006, 2007. I honestly don't know the timing of that, and it's not in the record. There are no allegations about it. But even were it the case that this incident happened in 2007 and the city chose ultimately in 2008 to begin disciplinary proceedings, there still has to be a link that the termination was because of her disability. And falling out of a squad role is not it doesn't put the city on notice that she is, in fact, she has a disability within the meaning of the Rehabilitation Act. Sending her for psychological examination, similarly, at most is a suspicion that she might not be fit for police duty. But that is very different from knowing or suspecting that she has a disability. Psychological problems could be a very large realm of things. It could be anything from feeling upset because something bad happened to you to ultimately being diagnosed with a mental impairment that would qualify under the Rehabilitation Act. But Ms. Brumfield doesn't come forward with anything else than this conclusory, overarching psychological problems. And it's important to note that each time the city sent her for these evaluations, the results came back fit for duty. So even if the city did suspect that she wasn't fit for duty, and if that were enough to suspect she had a disability, each time that came back and the city was disabused of any notion that she did, in fact, have a disability. So Ms. Brumfield's counsel in opening mentioned the accommodation.
Well, on those responses to the fitness test where it says susceptible to stress or something to that nature, doesn't that give the city some clue about a disability?
We submit that is not enough to plead that that the city perceived her to have a disability as susceptible to stress is not necessarily due to a disability. There's a broad range of reasons one could be susceptible to stress without necessarily having a disability. So at most, the city suspected she was not fit to perform as a police officer. Of course, the city has an obligation to send an officer that it doesn't, that it has questions about whether she is fit for duty for evaluation to see if she can perform her duty, but that does not equal a perception that she, in fact, has a disability. And, she was susceptible to stress. That's what it came back as. But it also came back that she was fit to perform her duty. So from that, it's impossible to conclude that the city perceived her to be disabled. But even if the city did perceive her to have a disability, that alone would not be enough for her to state a Rehabilitation Act claim. But because, of course, she needs both parts. She needs a perception of disability or that she actually had a disability. And she needs to show a link between the city's adverse employment action and the disability. And that, if it fails, whether or not she can state a claim, can state an allegation that she has a disability actually, or that the city regarded her as having a disability, she still cannot state a claim based because she cannot allege that the city terminated her because of her disability. And even today, we still haven't heard more than the conclusory statement that the city terminated her because of her disability. We have, or the city terminated her because of a failure to accommodate her disability. which doesn't state a claim under the Rehabilitation Act either. Just regarding the accommodation claim, briefly it was mentioned, Ms. Brumfield did not allege that she actually asked for an accommodation, that she informed the city what her disability was, and that there was anything the city could have done to accommodate her. So the claim states for that reason. Also, she still has not alleged, even today, what her disability even is, because today in opening, counsel stated that the disability is not being able to sleep, eat, or concentrate, but those aren't disabilities. Those are perhaps life, major life activities that an impairment of would, you know, couple with a disability, allow her to show a disability within the meaning of the Rehabilitation Act. But she needs both an impairment and the limitation on a substantial, on a major life activity in order to show actual disability. And just not sleeping, eating, and concentrating is not a disability in and of itself. So, unless there are further questions, we respectfully ask that this court affirm the district court's judgment.
Thank you, Ms. Layton. Ms. Rentz? Your time has expired, but you may have 2 minutes.
I'll be safe. Your Honor, I would just like to briefly contend some of the things that the respondent has said. First, she said that there was no link between the adverse employment and the disability. However, at the time of the incident for which they allege plaintiff was fired for, the city itself sent the plaintiff to psychological testing. Now, that is a sign or an inference which this court should take in favor of the plaintiff that the city was aware of her disability. Secondly, it is important to note that in the plaintiff's complaint itself, she never stated that she was fired specifically for that incident. Rather, she was fired for a series of actions that the city failed to take or took to exacerbate her disability, and not because of the actual incident in June of 2006. Thirdly, opposing counsel stated that there were not dates in the brief or in any of the proceedings as to when the examinations occurred, and that is simply not true. The first examination occurred in June of 2006. The second occurred in February of 2007. The incident where Ms. Brumfield fell and feigned injury occurred in April of 2007. So that was 2 months after the second evaluation, meaning that the city was aware or at least concerned of psychological issues for over a year prior to the incident. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rentz. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will stand in recess.